Good.
Thank you. So we've got to two, and actually, I think we've just got a third
one coming through. An inquiry this morning on Vacuum Cooling, I think.
That was that. I know, wasn't it? Yeah.
So, but there's then looks to be quite a bit of a trend in Vacuum Cooling. So it's an opportunity to review it. So what is Vacuum Cooling and how does it work? So essentially, a liquid will boil at typically 100 degrees or 212 Fahrenheit.
And then if you reduce the pressure, it will continue to boil.
So by reducing the pressure, we can essentially keep cooling.
The point's actually where we can actually freeze it. So, how
do we go about doing that?
Essentially, what we do is we place the product into a vacuum-rated vessel, and we apply a vacuum to it. We continue to reduce the vacuum until we're getting down to about 29 inches on the mercury scale. Switching is essentially ultimate vacuum.
Yeah.
30 inches is ultimate, but we're down to 29, almost 30 inches. Now, you can't measure them on a typical pressure gauge, so we have to use an absolute vacuum gauge for that, but that's just an aside. So how does it actually cool? So by getting water to evaporate, actually in a room will evaporate normal atmospheric conditions. By reducing it, it gives off, it'll evaporate even further. So it essentially boils, it continues to evaporate until you get the moisture in and it'll freeze solid.
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing, which is harvesting that process and cooling the product. So the equipment that we need is typically a batch cooling vessel, a liquid ring vacuum pump, a steam ejector, a condenser, and a condensate recovery tank. But I've kind of left that off because I've got a couple of options. So, how does it happen? What's the process as we go through the actual cooling process? We put the product into the batch cooling vessel, and then we reduce the pressure. We do that by sucking the air out and using a liquid clean vacuum pump. And we have to be really careful how we do that, because if we apply the vacuum too quickly, the products will boil. And then essentially what we'll do, we'll end up sending all the product down the vacuum pump. And it does happen, I've seen it happen. So we do have to be really careful how we manage that. So we do reduce the pressure carefully. And normally we do that over a period of time, and you'll find in the BCH refers to that as a ramp period. As we continue to reduce the pressure, the product will give off its temperature, and the resulting vapor steam is going down the vacuum duct. And essentially what we do is we condense it. If we don't condense it, the actual liquid vacuum pump will start to boil. So the water in the liquid ring will boil, and so you lose all the vacuum in the vacuum pump. So we have to make sure that we condense it before it gets through to the vacuum system. Okay?
Yeah.
Things that condense up. And then you get to a point where you can't actually condense it anymore, because the cooling water on the condenser is probably higher than the product temperature or the steam temperature. So that's where we introduce the steam ejector. And the steam ejector serves as a dual purpose. It's not really a venturi, but it resembles a venturi if you look at it. But essentially, it's a steam pump. And the simple process is that what it does, by introducing steam, it creates more of a vacuum, which enables us to get down to the lower pressures that we need. But also, it increases the temperature of the steam as it carries over, condensing it down using water temperatures that are actually higher than the product temperature. So if you think about part 100, I think it's quoted two temperatures. He's quoted a cooling tower at 25 degrees C. The next at 35, I think, typically. And then he's quoted a chilled water supply of 6.5 degrees C. I don't know what the return temperatures on that, but let's say it's like is it something like that? Yeah. So, both of those temperatures are considerably hotter than the actual target temperature of the product, which is 4 degrees C. So when you think about it, cooling temperature is higher. We're still condensing, we're still cooling in the chamber. So that's how we do it. So that's what that steam pump is doing. It's actually increasing the steam temperature as it goes across the condenser, allowing it to evaporate. They allow it to condense.
That was an interesting aha moment.
when I was talking with the client about how the water supply for the condenser did not need to be at the product temp. Yeah, and they were trying to wrap their heads around that and explain how the evaporative process actually did all of the work.
Yeah.
And that the utility was just to condense down.
Yeah.
They had their aha moment of, okay, this is using physics to cool things down faster and more efficiently than an actual scrape surface or having to supply water at that cold temperature.
Years ago, we used to use just city water, and we just put city water in there. The water would enter the liquid ring stage, and it would warm up, and then it'd go down drain. And, well, that's using a lot of water. That can't be where it is, but it's something not certain. But it used to be 17 meters, so what's that, 4 gallons? 4 gallons, yeah, 4 gallons a minute. So what we can actually do now, we put water in, use the pump as the circulator, push it back out again, and then put it through another little condenser. Mm-hmm. And typically that's a tank of water with a coil inside it.
Yep.
And then what you do is you keep that cooling water in the pump head at a good even temperature as well. And that prevents it from putting the pump head. So I don't know, does that explain it in simplistic terms, opposed to the process or principles of vacuum cooling?
Thanks.
Yeah.
Without
going into a lot of physics and everything else. Yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah. And it was, so I just wanted to go through that. So we knew what the piece of equipment was. The customer said, oh, why are we using a condenser? That's why we're using a condenser. Yeah, well, we're using the steam ejector. That's why we're using that. Now, I can't remember exactly. I think the steam ejector is quite a high pressure. It's something like 45 PSI. That's not.
Yep. Probably one of your products.
James Bond over there.
Smith, I've done Smith.
Sorry, Brian, do you say? What's that you said? I think they use steam pressure on the ejector at about 45 psi. But I think I have used it quite a bit higher at some point.
That's the same 7 bar.
Is it 7 bar? Is it reduced down further? Yeah. Yeah, you can see there's a pressure reducing valve there after the gauge. I think typically it's about 45 PSI.
Okay.
It is quite important that steam pressure is maintained throughout a whole phase because it will affect the cooling process. And then the other thing we have to look at, you know, some of the typical problems you find when you're cooling is obviously, the rapid boiling off, we have to be really careful about that. Yeah. You could lose the product down the vacuum duct. The design of the batch vessel, it does look really, really big by comparison. So physically, it's probably about another 50% bigger than a typical vessel. And that's really to unveil that expansion. So since you want to encourage it to boil, obviously, that's the process. But you want to encourage it to boil, but without going down the vacuum duct. So, there's a couple of ways of doing that. One is the method is enlarge the size of the vessel. So it actually foams and then it'll get to a certain point where it can't sustain the same weight anymore. It'll just hold it.
Okay.
Without going back down the vacuum duct. So another way is you can actually put a valve on there and you can modulate the valve. And so we did two things really. We have a big vessel, but also we do modulate the pressure that we're reducing it by to control the foaming.
Is there any possibility for product degradation with vacuum cooling?
Degradation? Not really. We're evaporating off water, so typically we want to put more water in, and we usually do that at the start of the process. I do know companies that do it at the end of the process, but for me, you've gone through this pasteurization step of boiling the products, and then you're adding cold water afterwards, which isn't essentially processed, pasteurized. So the ideal time to do it is just before you start cooling it. Mm. I'd say typically 10%. It is product dependent, but it can be anything between sort of 2 to 12%, I guess. But the average is around about 10. The vacuum system, it can be sited outside. It can be over 100 feet away from the actual batch vessel. The steam ejector is quite noisy, and liquid ring vacuum block is quite noisy too.
Mm.
So normally they do go outside. Yep. And they are quite often just covered. They can be underneath a very simple rain cover. Yep. We do everything stainless steel. And we even do a stainless steel liquid wind vacuum pump. A bit more expensive, but it could all be sited outside. The motors are IP rated for that. And so it literally could all go out. The vacuum duct is all stainless steel. So some of the issues you might come across when you're vacuum cooling is, otherwise there's no harm to them. The only thing is, if you've got something that's really, really tender, like some chicken breast, you know, we are subjecting it to vacuum. So we are creating some, not shear, but we're agitating it all the time.
Yeah.
And so you can separate chicken breast a little bit, just slightly separate. And some, like really soft peppers, they might show a little bit of degradation, but nothing that the customer would spot as such or be complaining about.
Okay. How big is the duct itself, the vacuum? Depending on size.
It purely depends upon size. I think on a 650-gallon cooling vessel, we go up to 14-inch diameter.
Okay.
But a 125-gallon is 8-inch. The gallon, I think, in is 10 to 12-inch. But once it's installed, there's nothing.
Yeah.
And apart from cleaning it, there's nothing to be had from it. And for cleaning, typically we install spray balls in there, so we can clean the vacuum duct that way. Another way is we can put detergent in the cooling vessel, just allow it to boil. We literally get rid of that ramp. Pull it up, apply a full vacuum to it, open the valve and just suck the contents down the vacuum duct. And the velocity that it travels at, it just scour that and clean anything off. The actual vacuum system can handle it. It doesn't get as far as the vacuum pump. It only gets as far as it can insert, then condense and then put down the drain as dirty water. And the condensate tank is normally sized for a batch. So, you know, we've got the vacuum condenser, and then underneath it is the condensate collection tank. That's normally allowed to, the water's normally allowed to condensate in there. It'll then fill, and then at the end of a cycle, we just open a valve and then dump it to drain. You do need to clean that condensate tank occasionally, but once a week is normally fine. Because you will get carryover product go down the vacuum duct. We can't avoid it. You will get stuff go airborne. What we try and do is just minimize it, you know.
So that water is not necessarily recovered.
It's not clean and it's not recoverable.
Okay.
Compared to like screen surface heat exchanger, like cleaning time is about, is there any
cleaning time?
A cleaning time.
It's typical sort of cleaning cycle. Yeah, I mean, this would be, you clean this in about 10 minutes, you know.
Okay.
If you've got your detergent already down the vessel, for example, and then you suck it over to this vessel, the batch cooling vessel, and then go through a cleaning cycle, yeah.
Okay.
Anything from 10 minutes to 25 minutes, I'm guessing, like a typical clean sock. Anything with if you're looking at a scrape surface, heat exchanger, they're quite a bit bigger, so you need the velocity to get through it. Right. So the time normally would be extended in a scrape because you have to rely on contact time as opposed to velocity.
That's kind of what you said that about it, pulling through them back, you know.
Yeah, you pull it out there.
You pick the rebar.
That makes sense.
I can quote you the velocity, but I haven't got it either.
But I do understand
because
you need it.
But it hits thousands and thousands of feet a second.
Yeah.
That's neat. It's nice. It's on.
Right.
CIP
or built. You don't need a CIP system. We've put spray balls in occasionally to give it a hot rinse, and you don't have to do that every day. Most people would do a deep clean once a week. The good thing is, you know, that when you're applying the vacuum, the flow is always going away from the batch vessel, so it doesn't really necessarily go back and contaminate.
Yeah,
but it really depends on each user and how often they clean it.
Yeah.
Most will clean them every single day. And you want to clean the vessel every night as well. So as the product is agitated in the vessel, typically we use a horizontal agitator, so it's nice and gentle. And the main reason of that is just to ensure even distribution of heat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a slow turning agitator. Most often we don't actually put scrapers in there either. We just get the agitator close enough to the wall. And, you know, some people will ask for scrapers so that they can ensure it completely empties if they got a particularly viscous product.
How worried? like a high fat content sauce bear in the vacuum, like a cheese sauce or like a butter chicken.
The cheese sauce, it's going to take longer. Mm-hmm. The main reason for that is this ramp process at the start, because the proteins in the cheese are one
foam.
Yeah. Right. So we have to manage that. So typically you know, before you get down to the lower pressures that we need, then we have to slow that down.
Mm.
And typically you're not going to get down to your lower pressures until you're down below 70 Celsius.
Yep.
And that's roughly where most high dairy content sauces will stop foaming.
Okay.
The steam ejector normally comes on around about 45 Celsius. I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit, but that's when we normally apply the steam ejector. And that's how it is.
Confused a little bit here. Just on the pop-up ejectors in the corn vessel.
Well, the pop-up ejectors in, they're only there for corn. For cleaning.
Okay, that's what I assume, but I just wanted.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, cool. There is a story behind this, actually. A customer had issues.
Nice.
Yeah, they had issues where one vessel was taking longer than the other, so they had two systems. And they found that the vessel that was cooling quicker had a leak on the steam ejector nozzle.
In the vessel.
Not on the injector.
Not on the ejector, on the inside the vessel. And it transpired that if you introduce steam into the product, you actually call it quicker.
Yeah. That's as far as I'm going with that.
I do have the theory, have the reasoning behind it, and I'll share it with you if you really want to know. So I think the customer actually asked if we could make the other one leak.
Yeah.
To get matching times. I just know the details of that. So, yeah, I'm not sure whether we did actually make the other one leak or not. Whether we opened it during the process, not made it leak, but you know, if we simulated it during the process. But yeah, that was an ongoing problem for quite a while. Why we had one thing, exactly the same products and exactly the same systems, and exactly the same length of vacuum duct, and one was taking 10 minutes longer than the other cool.
Yeah.
And that was right. Yeah. Step the box in bowels leaking.
Do they have one bag set between job?
No, they have been independent vacuum sets dedicated to each individual vessel. But it's a good question, because you can actually have one vacuum set shared between a number of different coolers, but you can't apply cooling to all of them at the same time.
Right.
Not with one vacuum set.
Okay.
Even so, beside hands.
Yeah, that one. See how that'll work.